This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
My name is Monica Lindemann. I'm the Head of Development here at the National Museum, and I'm very delighted to introduce a wonderful speaker today. Dr. Elizabeth Truswell is a geologist and currently a visitor in the School of Earth Sciences at the ANU. During her undergraduate studies at the University of Western Australia, she discovered the field of palynology, which, for those of you who don't know, is the study of fossils and living pollen grains and plant spores. This study combined her passion for botany with geology. So after completing her science degree in 1962, Dr. Truswell received a British Commonwealth Scholarship and went to Cambridge University, where she was awarded a PhD in 1966. In the early 70s, Dr. Truswell was a postdoctoral research scientist at Florida State University, researching deep sea drilling and how it relates to Antarctic floral history. Then in 1973, Dr. Truswell moved to Canberra to take up a position with the Bureau of Mineral Resources, which is now Geoscience Australia. This is where she worked until 1996. Then, in a very interesting career twist, since leaving Geoscience Australia, Dr. Truswell returned to an earlier interest in art, and in particular to an exploration of the intersection between art and science. She has exhibited works at the Canberra School of Arts. I'd also mention that somewhere in there, Dr. Truswell had a beautiful baby girl who is now working with children with disability in the Blue Mountains in a primary school there. Now, before I welcome Dr. Truswell to the stage, I did neglect to mention, sorry, that this is a recorded event, so please be aware of that, and also to let you know that there will be time for questions at the end, but just wait for the microphone with your questions. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Truswell. Thank you.
Thanks, Monica, and good morning, and thank you for coming. I thought that because I'm speaking here at the National Museum, I thought I'd begin by showing you the only item that I've donated to the museum collection, because it also offers a way of introducing you to the area of science that's been my life. And this item is a chair. It's a very handsome chair. It's a swivel chair with curved arms and back, and very neatly turned wooden supports, and there's a very comfortable leather cushion on it. The chair belonged to one Dr. Irene Crespin. Now, Dr. Crespin was a remarkable lady. She was the first Commonwealth paleontologist. Now, I rescued this chair from a dump at the back of the then Bureau of Mineral Resources, now Geoscience Australia. It seemed far too valuable and too historic to end up in the rubbish dump. So I presented it to the museum. Now, it's the chair that Dr. Crespin used while sitting at her microscope, where she examined these very tiny fossils. And they are foraminifera. They're single-celled organisms that live in the sea, both in deep and shallow water. They're made of calcium carbonate, and as you can see, they're often very beautiful. The ones that have been shown here are photographed with the scanning electron microscope. And Dr. Crespin, in her time, would have been using a light microscope. But these, they're like a whole range of different kinds of fossils. They're useful not only because they shed light on the life of the past, but they can also be used to establish the age of the rocks from which they're recovered. And they can also tell us a great deal about past environments and past climates. And now they're increasingly used, not only this group of fossils, but many fossils, are increasingly used to give us a kind of baseline where we can measure the changes that are happening in the world today, both in the general climate and in the climate of the oceans. Dr. Crespin graduated from Melbourne University in 1919. She was a contemporary and a friend of such luminaries as Bob Menzies and Sir Keith Hancock. Now, her first appointment was to the then Department of Home Affairs in Melbourne. She came to Canberra in 1936 to set up a laboratory here in the organisation that was then to become the Bureau of Mineral Resources. That was established in 1946 with the purpose of looking at Australia's mineral and energy resources immediately after after the Second World War. Now, Irene, as I knew her in her latter years, was a pioneer of science. She was well ahead of her time. She travelled widely and she made contacts with scientists right around the world. And she was very adventurous. At one time, she allowed herself to be lowered in a bucket down a well in Victoria so she could take samples from the rocks as she went down. And she was very resourceful in other ways, in getting hold of material to work on. And it's said that she was able to persuade ship's captains to drop their anchors in a particular place on the seafloor so she could have the scrapings off the anchor to build up her own knowledge of what was going on in the on the seafloor. So that was a very far cry, a very different way of obtaining samples from the seafloor from the present sophisticated and highly technical arrangements for drilling in the seafloor, and I'll talk about that later. Now, I've dwelt on Dr. Crespin, firstly because we hold here in the museum these records of her work, and secondly because I too am a paleontologist. Now, I spend a great deal of my working life in what's now Geoscience Australia, and I've worked with microfossils, but mine are of a different kind entirely. I work with the pollen of living and fossil plants. The word pollen was applied from in about the 1940s, and it comes from the Greek polluno, which means dust, and it's applied to both living and fossil pollen. Palynology, the study of pollen, is very useful. In my case, I've used it for looking at the vegetation of the past and also for tracking the evolutionary history of particular groups of plants, particularly those in the Australian vegetation. And because pollen's been changing through time, it's been evolving, you can also use it to establish the age of the rocks that it's recovered from. And, of course, because plants are so dependent on climate, it can be used to give us a past picture of climates. And, of course, it's also very beautiful. Pollen is very tough stuff. It has to be because it transmits the genetic material. It transmits the male genetic material, carrying it to the female parts of the plant. It's transported by wind in some cases, or by insects, by birds, by a range of other animals to get it onto the female part of the plant. And it's made up, in the fossil record, all that you find are the walls of the pollen. The interior contents are gone, but the walls are very tough. They're made of a kind of complex protein, and so they are preserved. Pollen accumulates by being washed into lakes and rivers, accumulating on the bottom there and also on the seafloor, and eventually it gets covered by more sediments, by silt, that that may become consolidated to form a hard rock. And it has to be extracted from the rock by using very nasty acids, and they don't affect the pollen walls at all. But if you really want to see how much pollen can be produced, you need to walk through reed when those great cypress trees are flowering, and you will see that there'll be a yellow rim around puddles and along the gutters, and you could almost shovel it up. That's because they're wind-pollinated. Wind-pollinated plants produce a lot of pollen, and that's a wonderful example. It's very varied in its structure. It's the pollen of one of the wattles, where all the cells sort of cling together and they don't move apart. Here is one of an extremely ancient pollen grain extracted from rocks about 250 million years old. And you can see it's got a pair of sacs at each end of the grain, and they serve to orient the grain or to help it be transported through the air. Now, when I was working for the Bureau of Mineral Resources, much of my day-to-day work was using palynology as a tool to establish the age and environment of parts of the sedimentary basins in Australia, the basins that were examined for minerals, for petroleum, coal. Now there's also a lot more emphasis on using that area and using what we know in the study of groundwater to support our cities and agriculture. But I've always had another interest, and that was more biological than geological. And this interest has my roots in the PhD I did that I was lucky enough to do at Cambridge University in England. And my thesis there was concerned with the story of the flowering plants. When did the flowering plants come into the record? When did they come and displace the less well-developed plants like the conifers and the ferns? At some time in the age of the dinosaurs, the flowering plants came to dominate the world's vegetation. So the parts of the geological section that I was looking at in England were just those parts where we began to see the flowering plants pollen coming in. And the area that I worked on, my thesis area, was the south coast of England, and it was a very beautiful area. I would work there, climbing around on the cliffs and taking samples that I'd then take back to the lab in Cambridge and process for their pollen. But they were lovely areas to work in. They're very picturesque and beautiful, and they're in the cliffs themselves. There was a story not only of geological history, but there were stories of human history. Now, some of the sections that I worked with, and this Lulworth Cove was one of the key points for me, some of the sections that I worked with had been described by early geologists who published their work in the 1840s. There was a gentleman called Gideon Algernon Mantell. Mantell was a doctor, very interested in geology, and he'd mapped all of these sections, and he was one of the first people who actually identified the fossils that eventually became the dinosaurs. But I could work with his published notes, and I could identify bed by bed as I worked up those cliffs using his information. And the other aspect of it that's got a lovely human history down there and a bit more colourful is that it was a great part of the coast for the pirates. And most of the cliff sections have their names taken from pirates who worked there. There's one called the Black Gang Chine, and I worked up the Black Gang Chine, but it was lovely. I came back to Australia after finishing my PhD, and I was quickly offered a position in Perth, which was where I'd grown up, and that was to work with a petroleum exploration company. And they employed palynologists, people like me, to date the rocks they were drilling through in the search for oil in the northwestern of Australia. Now, it was pretty routine sort of work, and I found it fairly flat, I suppose, after Cambridge and doing research. So I was soon looking for something where there was a little bit more of a research component, where there was more freedom, I suppose, to follow the routes that I wanted to go. And I was soon offered a postdoctoral position in the US at Florida State University in Tallahassee. And they have there an Antarctic research facility where they store cores from the continent or from around the continent of Antarctica. But I was always intrigued by the fact that this Antarctic research facility had palm trees over the door. That was quite lovely. But while I was there, I was invited to be part of a team that was investigating the geology of the seafloor around Antarctica. Now, this was part of a major international program that was looking into things like the history of the present ice cap around Antarctica. How long has it been there? And what about the environments around in the seas around Antarctica? How have they been changing? You know, there's a major current that flows right around Antarctica now, one of the biggest currents in the world's oceans, and that connects all the oceans of the world and has a major effect on climate. And what's the history of that current? And these sort of questions can be answered, at least in part, by looking at the sediments that have accumulated on the seafloor around the Antarctica. I jumped at the chance of being a part of this because it seemed to me that it would give me the opportunity to look at pollen that must have been washed off the continent and that would have give us some clues as to the vegetation that existed there prior to the ice cap. Now, the research was carried out under the aegis of a very large international program, the Deep Sea Drilling Program. It's a program that's now been running for 40 years, and it's had various manifestations, and it's probably one of the biggest science programs ever. As a matter of fact, it was set up just at the time when the Americans were becoming interested in getting a man on the moon. So there was a sort of tempo around, I suppose, for big science projects. And that was when the Deep Sea Program was set up. It was first set up as a purely American program. Then it became international. And now it remains international. Australia is a contributor to it. The program now runs two ships, both of which are equipped to drill holes in the seafloor. There's no commercial interest whatsoever. If they look like they might strike oil anywhere, they've just got to get out of it. But at the present, the Japanese have developed one ship and the Americans another. But the ship that I sailed on was the first of their drill ships. It was a pioneer in the program, and it was known as the GLOMAR Challenger. Now, GLOMAR stands for Global Marine. That's the company that built the ship. The Challenger in its title reflects HMS Challenger. And here again, I constantly find that in science you keep coming up against this human history and human stories of the people who've been there before. Now, the original Challenger set sail from Portsmouth in England in 1872. And for the next 4 years, it voyaged around the world, sampling, dredging the ocean floor, measuring the water chemistry. It was the very first oceanographic expedition that was set up. It was the first expedition that was mounted by the Royal Society of London to understand the science of the sea. Now, in a sense, this first Challenger, I think, is a kind of spiritual ancestor to the deep sea drilling program. That's really the background to it. The present program has drill holes in all of the world's oceans. The holes run into thousands now. And they've contributed largely to our understanding of plate tectonics, to volcanoes, to past climate change, including periods of very rapid climate change, and, of course, to understanding things like earthquake zones. So that's the background to the science program. What was my interest in it as a pollen person? Well, it's been known for a long time that Antarctica, for much of its history, has borne a very substantial vegetation. And it was a vegetation very similar to that of the other Gondwana continents. And this happened at the same time as Antarctica. It's always been sitting there over the South Pole, but nonetheless, it was vegetated. And until recently, most of the evidence we had for that vegetation came from macrofossils, not from pollen, but from leaves and stems that were found in the very limited outcrops on the continent. And the most famous of these fossil plants from Antarctica were the ones that were collected on Scott's fatal expedition. They were collected on the Beardmore Glacier, and this was after the party had reached the South Pole and discovered there the Norwegian flag left there by Amundsen. So they were pretty dejected, really at the end of their tether, mentally and physically, and they were heading back to a depot which would have saved them. They took a day to collect fossils as they went down the Beardmore Glacier. And these fossils were subsequently identified as Glossopteris, which was the story of them was, well, the fossils were found in the tents with the bodies of the party, of the polar party. They were taken back to London. Their story was published in 1914. And it was then realised how Antarctica was kind of a key part of Gondwana land, so that there was a major contribution to science came out of that that rather unfortunate expedition. And the gentleman who retrieved the fossils and insisted on their being kept was Edward Wilson. He was the artist, the scientist, and the physician to the party, and a very remarkable man. But my interest wasn't in this part of the vegetation story. What I was trying to do was get a picture of the vegetation that immediately preceded the present ice cap that covers Antarctica before it was finally extinguished by increasing cold. What was it like? Was it a tundra? Whatever. And the answer to this seemed to be likely to be found in the pollen record. We've known from dredges off Antarctica that the sediments out there are pretty well full of pollen. But most of it has been scrambled up by the glaciers, and it's very hard to unravel the history of the vegetation from that. So what we needed was a section or sections just drilled below the surface before the ice became this dominant activity. And the drilling program developed by the DSTP seemed to offer, by the International Drilling Program, seemed to offer the best way of getting at this picture. So I applied to join this first cruise in Antarctic waters. But the powers that be didn't want a palynologist. They thought it was too difficult to extract this pollen at sea, which was probably quite right. So they said, come along, but be a sedimentologist instead. So I had to be an instant expert in the sediments that accumulate on the sea floor. These are mostly sediments that come from the tiny organisms that live at the surface and then they drift down. So, they have a lovely record of climate change. But anyway, because this particular venture, this particular cruise was due to leave from Fremantle, I went back to my old alma mater, the University of Western Australia, to update myself as a sedimentologist. And anyway, eventually I got to join the ship at Fremantle, and that was a very exciting departure. And I'll just show you a few shots around the ship. When I went aboard, I was introduced to my dozen or so fellow scientists who came from institutes all around the world, and to the drillers. These were muscly young men, who had previously worked on drill ships in the Gulf of Mexico, very muscly young men, and boy, could they eat. It's fantastic. I was shown the very well-equipped labs, and that's me on deck. And what happens in this drilling activity is that a bit is lowered to the seafloor, but it's lowered through a series of 9-metre cores, drill cores, and here's one core on deck. This is a steel core, and they are sort of screwed one on top of the other until you have a long core, and the drilling then pushes the sediment up through these cores, through these metal cores. There they are, all stacked, ready to go on the front of on the bow of the ship. Now, in the best tradition of Antarctic explorers, I kept a diary, and I'll read you just a few of those little bits as I go along. We left Fremantle on the 20th of December, 1972, and quite amazingly, it was precisely 100 years after the original Challenger, the first scientific expedition left Portsmouth in Britain in December. Actually, it was December the 21st they left Britain in 1872. That was amazing. Now, my diary for that first day reads, "The ship left Fremantle in a warm dusk. I grew up mostly in Perth, so the local landscape was a familiar one. It had been strange and exciting to feel the throb of the ship as it moved down the harbour, past the rocky groins, and then turned hard left. There was nothing in front of us then but a huge expanse of ocean and the coast of Antarctica." The first hole they drilled on the Naturalist Plateau. Now, trying to move the pointer. Oh, where's the pointer gone? Anyway, you could see off southwestern Australia, there's a little blocky bit of geology that sticks up there. The hashed areas are the higher parts of the seafloor. And you can see that Southeast Indian Ridge is high, and that's where new seafloor is being generated that's actually pushing Australia away from Antarctica. We travelled right down to the Antarctic coast, then around to the, eventually ending up in the Ross Sea. Now, I don't know why I can't, it's just a matter of finding the way the pointer should move. Well, I can't work it, but right around there in the Ross Sea where we drilled a number of holes. But the first hole on the Naturalist Plateau was interesting because it was the first time that all these scientists had been brought together. We were not particularly confident about the roles that we had, and this was something of a test run. And the sense of anticipation was absolutely palpable. And my diary from there reads, "Of this feisty team of scientists, nobody seems the least bit confident about their ability to do the assigned job," and I found that refreshing. "We wait a whole morning before the first core comes up. Folk occupy this time of tension with another peek down the microscope or with hassling over all possible contingencies. But our introduction to the drilling goes smoothly enough, and no doubt we'll get used to the 18-hour days and the pressure during the actual drilling. An entourage of albatrosses has followed us for the last 2 days, half a dozen of them on average. I think they're wanderers. They swoop and glide over just behind us and briefly settle in the wake to pick up scraps, giant but elegant scavengers. This one I can't identify, etc. I'd taken a few books with me, and I'd taken Edward Wilson's diaries from his Antarctic expedition. And I'd also taken his magnificent Birds of Antarctica. Wilson was a marvellous artist, amongst other things. So we progressed south, stopping and positioning the ship every few days and selected sites. And in between these sites, there was a frenzy of activity, cutting and sampling core, recording it, being covered in wet mud at 3 o'clock in the morning. And just a couple of more extracts from the diary will give you a flavour of the way one had to work at that time. There was always a sense of anticipation before one came to the next drill site. But ours was a very curious situation, as the diary for the 31st of December reads. "We're slow in approaching the next hole. Stayed up to watch us come on site around midnight. Strange to be making such a concerted effort to arrive, watching depth recorders, seismic records, satellite navigation, all directed to this place we're steaming for, then to have it all come together and actually arrive with a distinct feeling of relief at this unmarked spot in a dark grey ocean. We're here, but there's no crowds, no road signs, no station platform, but we're here, the sea flat and grey and snowflakes in the air." And after we sighted the first icebergs, they became a real hazard to drilling operations. And again, I read from the diary, "Site 4 was an iceberg saga. When we came on site, the sea was dead calm, but there was a cluster of bergs lurking to port. There was an enormous one on the horizon some 16 miles away. That was the chief hazard. It was on a slow but steady track towards our spot. Our situation must be a unique one in navigational history. I'm being stationary on account of being tied to the floor by a long steel string, and thus in danger of having an iceberg run into us. How very different from the Titanic. Anyway, that hole was very difficult. We pushed it down pretty quickly in about half a day, watching the icebergs that were heading for us. And the captain eventually said, you know, we've got to pull out of here and go. So about 4 a.m. we went to bed and the crew did the rest. And at that point we steamed for about a mile and a half out of the iceberg's track, dragging nearly 3 miles of steel pipe under us on the bottom, just above the seafloor. So we progressed south, and as always, we seemed to be in the path of explorers, people who'd been there before. Now, at one point, we crossed the track of Captain Cook in his second voyage of 1772 in the Resolution, and he was seeking the fabled Great South Land. But he circumnavigated Antarctica, although he never saw it. And in his own words, he said, "I've now made a circuit of the Southern Ocean in such a manner as not to leave the least room for the possibility of there being a continent unless very near the pole." Now, again, I didn't realize until recently the coincidence of the dates. We were there in January 1973. We crossed the path that Cook had taken in the early part of 1773. Now, I've yet to establish exactly that precise date, but that's just an interesting point. We moved into the Ross Sea and just north, drilled holes north of the Great Ice Barrier. But at that time, the sea was shallow. The bottom was full of pebbles and boulders dropped by the developing ice. The going was very hard, and there was no more time for diary keeping. Now, I couldn't achieve my aim then on that cruise of getting a pollen record that might have told the vegetation story, but I got involved in the other parts of the story and how long the ice cap had been there, and that was interesting. When we put to sea, people thought that ice cap, present ice cap, was about 2 million years old. We knocked it back to something like 25 million years, and that was pretty dramatic. But I've kept up work on Antarctic material, getting it from the same program, getting it from other colleagues, and it really wasn't until the year 2000 that a core was drilled very close to Antarctica that gave us a wonderful pollen record. And with a colleague, I worked on that material, and we published the story in 2009, and we called that story Polar Forests on the Edge of Extinction. Anyway, back in Australia at the Bureau of Mineral Resources, my own career path moved, as seems inevitable, from science into administration. While much of the time there was preoccupied with internal matters like budgets and other staffing matters, I did have a chance to be involved in much broader issues. I was involved with UNESCO in programs that were allowing young Australian scientists to take part in projects with people from developing countries. I was appointed to the management board of a couple of the cooperative research centres, you know, which bring together academia and government and industry. One of those was one on Antarctica, which seemed inevitable. The other one was on the focus on Australia's coastal zone, and that was particularly rewarding. But for the last 7 years of my employment with the government, I was trying to shift the focus, I suppose, away a little bit from minerals and energy towards the geological application of more environmental issues, linking geology with soils, and particularly how could we bring together the geological record and focus it on our present concerns about climate change. But then, as often happens, a crunch came, and the funding for those programs was dramatically cut. So I had the option of going back to do some fairly routine work or quitting my job and taking a different tack. And it took me about 5 minutes to decide on what I was going to do. Since childhood, I've had a love of drawing and painting. Over the years, I've pursued a lot of evening classes. And I think I was incredibly fortunate at that time to have two offers, both from the ANU. The School of Art accepted my portfolio, so I could do a degree in visual arts there. But at the same time, the Research School of Earth Sciences offered me a spot as a visiting fellow, so I took that up too. And so what I was doing, I suppose, was not all that unusual. I was working both in the arts and the sciences, and increasingly we do find artists working in scientific institutions, and I think that's very gratifying, the enormous amount of interest that there is in the relationship between the arts and sciences. It's just one of my own drawings that I'll just put up while I talk. But not only is there a great deal that's being written about the way the arts and science interrelate, it's almost a discipline on its own now, exploring what the relationship is between the two. And that explores things like what are the motivations for arts and sciences? Why do people do either of those? Both science and art seem to be involved with the way we perceive the world and the way we find our way through the world. Some people explain art by looking to neuroscience, look at the way the brain responds to images, and some people take a more evolutionary view. They look at some of the things that we admire in art. For instance, they claim that we like particular landscapes because they echo the landscapes that humans may have evolved in the savannas of Africa. And others look at it from the point of evolutionary biology. What is this aesthetic sense that we have, that both artists and scientists have? And does that have some kind of evolutionary significance? When did it develop? And did it give us some sort of advantage as humans evolved? You probably know scientists are actually more comfortable with the word beauty than are a lot of contemporary artists. The earth sciences offer a lot to the arts, especially to the visual arts. And as a paleontologist, I've spent a lot of time working with things like looking at the concept of time. When you're deciphering Earth history, you are dealing with that all the time, and you're dealing with time with numbers that you just can't get your head around. I mean, geologists, they use millions of years as a kind of currency, you know, tossed around in the tea room. But if you truly try and think about that, it's very difficult. And inevitably, one's building a picture of the past on fragments. We never have the whole picture. So how do you translate this view of the world into an art practice? How can one grapple with the issues? Now, firstly, if you look at landscape and behind it, you can see another landscape. Now, with respect to Antarctica, if I look at the present Antarctic, I'm very much aware of the vegetation that existed there before the present ice cap formed. Now, how do you express that in an art form? This is part of my honours work where I decided to do it in terms of a series of panels showing one landscape behind the other. Then expressing time. Now, it's very difficult to express time in visual arts. Time has different manifestations. It can be linear or it can be cyclic. The cycles of time obviously reflected in the seasons that we have, that we enjoy. So to express this, I drew again on the forest, and I was dealing with fossil woods that had been described from Antarctica, looking at the tree rings in those woods. Now, what happens when you look at cross sections of wood? You get big cells formed in spring and summer, and then as the growth shuts down or recedes, heading towards winter, it may completely shut down. So I built a series of works that I called Winter Wood, and I abstracted them as much as I could from reality, but essentially they were reflecting this seasonality and the cycles of time. So that was the kind of work that I did. They were based on fossil woods from the Cretaceous of Antarctica. And how do you bring these two languages of art and science together? Now, again, drawing on my Antarctic experience, I did a work that now hangs in the lecture theatre in the Research School of Earth Sciences, and that's a drawing about 4 metres long. And the way I made that one was just by photocopying a scientific paper of mine, then tearing it all up, sticking it back together, and drawing on top of it with this kind of forest image. And it was quite cathartic to tear up your own scientific paper. It was great fun. And then again, there's this issue of the fragmentary nature of our understanding. Now, I've focused on this in a number of ways. Some years ago, I decided that I liked working with natural media. I like working with local ochres, and you can find a lot of local ochres around Canberra, and charcoal. And my first exhibition I had in Canberra was at the Ankar Gallery in 2005, and it was all about different kinds of fossils. And the technique I used is to use heavy paper, wet it with a slurry of ochre, then draw on it with the charcoal, and then the charcoal flows around and makes interesting patterns. So this was a series of works that I did then. These little trilobites were abundant in the world's seas for a lot of the geological record. Sometimes I used text with them. I had another exhibition at the CSIRO Discovery Centre, and it went right back to my PhD work. Now people have got a lovely record of the early flowering plants, tiny little fossil flowers. I haven't worked with them myself, but I drew on other people's photographs and just used ochre cutting back into that to come up with a series of these little fossil flowers. But while there's a lot of my own art that is informed by my science background, there's another area of it, and I think that something that I had done as an experiment in printmaking using fossil pollen. I had an exhibition at the Kalgoorlie Regional Gallery. I was born in Kalgoorlie and spent my very early years there, and I discovered that they have an absolutely wonderful art gallery. And I did organise to have an exhibition there that was a logistic nightmare, actually, getting work across that. My family's got a very long history of living there. But it's the sense of place, I think, is important. And when I go back there, it's still the red earth and the wonderful local trees that move me. So I organised this exhibition in the Kalgoorlie Gallery, and I drew on the landscape around there. I drew looking at the great pit that now encompasses all the mines that are there, mines that my father had worked in. I did a series relating to the pit, again, just working with charcoal and ochre. That's more of that sequence. Then just the local landscape. There's a wonderful horizontality in it, and the great pipeline there kind of sets the scene. That's the pipeline that the engineer C.Y. O'Connor is famous for, and it transported water to the gold fields in 1900 from dams near Perth. But the local landscape has other things to offer. Every time I fly over there, I'm intrigued by the salt lakes they actually occupy old drainage channels in the landscape. Their different colours reflect the fact that they have different chemistry in them. But I love the way the fluid shapes of the lakes contrast with the rigid geometry of the fence lines and the pastoral areas. So that was another series, really, sense of place. But just finally, a sense of place can also be felt from where one lives now. And I've spent 30 years in Canberra, and it obviously resonates with me. I'd been travelling in Italy a couple of years ago, seeing some wonderful Renaissance art. thinking that when I came back, my whole art practice would be changed, and nothing happened. The epiphany just didn't happen. So I just started drawing from where I parked my car in the morning, and that was near Sullivan's Creek. So I just did a series of charcoal drawings reflecting on Sullivan's Creek that was exhibited at the art school here. And I invited a colleague of mine, the late Richard Barwick, who was a great photographer, had photographed the creek in all its moods, to join me in that exhibition. So that was the Sullivan's Creek show. And my current work is also related to a sense of place. My father was a surveyor. He worked in the Kimberleys and actually worked on the first site for what's now the Ord River Dam. And I hadn't been there until a couple of years ago, and then I took a trip around the Kimberley coast in a small boat. And what really resonated with me was these marvellous sandstone cliffs, and they all bear a white line, which is the high tide mark. And below that white line, which is a salty line, the rocks are dark, they're full of organisms, shells, anemones, etc. Above that, the cliffs are barren. So this is an exhibition in progress. It's going to be held next year at the Belconnen Arts Centre, and I've simply called it Tideline. So that's where I'm at now. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. That's an absolutely fascinating talk. What a diverse life you've led. I'm going to open up for questions now. I had a question first, and that is, have you been back to the Antarctica since 1972?
Yes, I have. Once, and I've also done one of these I've also done one of these flyovers of the Antarctic, which was a wonderful experience. A friend of mine who does it regularly and has spent his life working in Antarctica, he rang me one day and said, "What are you doing on Sunday?" And I said, "Nothing." And he said, "Would you like to come to Antarctica?" So we did a fantastic flyover. And when you do that, it was a time before people were very concerned about airline security. We could actually wander up to the captain's cabin, and he was, you know, he had a 747, and he would just sort of dip the wings and take it to wherever he wanted to see. So it was wonderful.
I wonder if any steps are being taken to collect seafloor sediments in the course of the search for the missing Malaysian aircraft in the southern Indian Ocean.
Look, that is very interesting, and actually I have just put together a little story that I've given to Robin Williams, and I hope he will broadcast it. In the region that they're looking for that Malaysian aircraft, it is an area of the sea floor that we don't have a huge amount of information about, but we do have perhaps more than the press would let us know. But in the centre of that region is the island complex of Kerguelen, which is administered by the French and which has an amazing history, both in terms of the natural history of the place and in terms of the human history. So I've just put together a little story about Kerguelen and how it is the centre of the area that they're now looking at, but it has such a remarkable history of its own.
Liz, I was just interested in your comments about trying to deal with the issue of time in visual art. Mm-hmm. You haven't ever moved off two-dimensional work to do perhaps sculptural stuff or installation where you might be able to layer more materials or something of that nature?
No, I haven't. I've seen wonderful things that people do, and I've seen a lot of work that's being done, particularly with respect to Antarctica. There's a series of conferences that have been organised about every 2 to 3 years looking at cultural aspects of Antarctica, and a lot of that is to do with installation, a lot of it's to do with performance, and, I mean, there are wonderful things like you'd be familiar with the krill that the whales feed on around Antarctica. Well, there is one Sydney artist now who's done the most amazing animations of krill and their life cycle. And not only are they fantastic animations and interesting in themselves, but the biologists have taken such an interest in these that they feel that they're learning a lot from her animations. So it's a wonderful interplay there between the art and the science.
Did your love has been with drawing?
No. I think that, you know, there's only so much you can encompass, and that's not... I like to draw, and that's where I sit.
Thank you very much. Yesterday there was quite an activity getting greater recognition for women in science with this, I think at the Academy of Science they hosted this bomb or something, getting more entries into Wikipedia for women in science. How's your experience been that this has been a problem for you and for Dr. Crispin? I must confess I was unaware of her work, and thank you for enlightening us about that.
Well, I feel that there have been times when I've felt that women were disadvantaged. Even going back to as an undergraduate at UWA, there were three or four of us women who went through at the same time, and we actually had a professor who organised separate excursions for the women. He really had a thing about women in science, and you know, actually we all went on to sort of do quite well. And then when I was working in the government here, and when I particularly when I'd moved into administration, I found that there was, I suppose, the thing that irked me and a lot of other women who've had senior positions in government is that too many decisions are made in the old boy network, or people who will gather for drinks at 5 o'clock, and when with small children you just can't do that. So, and I think that, I mean, that's still prevalent, but on the other hand, most of my career was involved in laboratories. I didn't do all that much work in the field. I did some, but it was not a problem. But the that activity that's been organised by the Academy of Science is an interesting one, and I don't know much about wiki bombs, but there was a push a couple of years ago to have more women fellows recognised in the Academy of Science, and that's been remarkably successful. I mean, they've been electing 20 people a year as fellows and for some years, and last year there were 11 of the 20 were women. So things are progressing.
Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.